And now I have the privilege to introduce our speaker to you this evening. Sherry is a constant and consistent member of our Monday night group, probably there as long as the group has been standing. And I'm sure she will share that with you and that you will give her your attention. And welcome Sherry to the podium.
I'm not as tall as she is. Maybe that. Okay, I feel like I'm behind a wall. Hi, I'm Sherry, and I'm very grateful to be a member of Al-Anon. When anyone asks me to tell my story, I always think of several things right away. I marvel, first of all, that I'm standing up here, that my knees are not jelly, that I'm doing this at all. The most people I think I ever spoke in front of before I got into Al-Anon was maybe one or two. So this is huge for me. I never was in a business or anything where I gave speeches or talked to groups of people. The other thing I think of is that maybe it's easier for an Al-Anon to tell a story than some alcoholics to tell their story in AA meetings, because we were starved to tell somebody our story. We were looking for anybody to listen when we were going through the hell we were going through, and didn't always find that, you know, listening ear or somebody to be there for us. And so maybe we're just glad to be up here telling you. Somebody is sitting there listening. The other thing I thought of today was that probably 15 years ago, my husband and I went across town to an Al-Anon speaker meeting. It was going to be Dr. Bob's son. And my husband was very enthused about this, hearing Dr. Bob's son speak as an Al-Anon. And when we got there, this place was full to standing room only. And they made the announcement that Dr. Bob's son did not make it to Atlanta. He was ill. And my husband immediately turned to me and said, "I am so disappointed. I wanted to know what it was like to live with Dr. Bob." And without taking a breath, I said, "I can tell you." And he, you know, he died laughing right there on the spot. I said, "No problem. I can tell you, you know." So anyway, a lot of my story, you know, there's hindsight, it's 2020, and a lot of that it's interspersed. I certainly didn't know all this about myself or my life when I was going through it. So you'll see where all that is. I was born in 1950 in Louisville, Kentucky, to a mother who, to this day, at 82, is a very critical person, very opinionated person. Very much a snob, and I realized that over the years, especially in my recovery period of time. My father was totally the opposite. He was the balancing force in our life growing up. He, you know, the wouldn't hurt a fly type person, very loving, wondered sometimes how he put up with her. But I feel like, in a big way, my mother was the alcoholic in my life growing up, and my father, God help him, needed Al-Anon, big time, to deal with her. And so, at a very, very early age, I was told over and over and over, and heard people, other people told, that that Sherry's very shy. Sherry doesn't talk to people. She's very shy. She'll hide behind the chair when you come. And at 4 years old, they put me in dancing school because that would help me not to be shy. Now, I'll insert there that to this day in recovery, I don't believe in shy. I don't believe any children out there shy. I think they're scared to death. I learned early on, I was just afraid to open my mouth, that it was going to be wrong, or, you know, I would be put down or something. And so very early on, I didn't talk. I, you know, a lot of my family would probably blow their mind to know I was speaking to anybody tonight. And I just grew up that way. You know, in school, it didn't matter if I knew the answer 200%. I would not raise my hand because there was that, you know, little bit that it might be wrong. And I didn't want to go through that. So I just stayed quiet. Went to 4 grade schools, being told all the time that kids are resilient, they bounce back, it'll be okay. I didn't have very many friends in those grade schools. I can think of one maybe in each place. The 4th one was in Indianapolis. We moved from Lowell to Indianapolis when I was in the 7th grade. And the other thing about those schools is we never moved at the beginning of the year or the end of the year. We moved like in the middle of the year, you know, like in the middle of October or, you know. And I didn't want to move to Indianapolis. I really didn't want to do that. We got up there. We got into a school in the middle of 7th grade. And it was very hard for me, very hard. I do remember there being in a group of friends, and I think I just kind of got inserted in there. There were girls that had been friends the whole time they had been at that school. And so time moved on. I then went to a high school across town. None of my friends went there. We moved across town, and I was the only person from my grade school that went to that high school. So again, I'm starting over. Always starting over, and no friends, you know, walking in the door. And that was extremely hard. Between my freshman and sophomore year, in August, I met my qualifier. Somebody recently at a meeting told me that in the North they don't call them qualifiers, but that's my very own alcoholic. And I was going to be 15, he was going to be 17, and we started dating. And this was like the best thing that ever happened to me. This was somebody who had a great sense of humor, who made me laugh, who listened to me, who seemed to care what I had to say. He was 2 years older than me. He was going to be a senior. And I was just blown away. This is great. My mom wasn't too happy about this. She, you know, you can't just date one person. I had already gone through the thing that she started me in first grade at 5 years old, because I remember her, and people say, you don't remember, you just heard the story, but I just remember that big flight of stairs, and there was a nun standing at the top of that stairs, and I remember my mom yelling up to her, she's ready, she's going to school. So at 5 years old, I started in first grade. Well, when I got to high school, I was younger than everybody in my class. Now, they're all going to start driving and dating and what have you. No, you can't do that. Well, a few months into it, they decided they couldn't say I couldn't do that because all of my friends were doing that. You know, were they going to make me bow out? So I the first date that my husband asked me on, my mom was in a car accident that night. And I thought, you know, this isn't funny, God. You know, I really want to go out with this guy. And I had gone out with a friend of my mother's son twice to get root beer on purpose so that by the time he asked me out, I could say, well, I did go out in a car with a boy. You know, you let me go there with what's-his-face, you know. And so we started dating. And a year into our dating, Scott went away to college. Well, then I really got a lot of flack, a whole lot of flack. You can't just date him. You have to date other people. And every single person that I did go out with for a short period of time, I would get in big trouble. They didn't like him. And I would start hearing speeches like, well, we've put Scott on a pedestal and, you know. And I'm like, you know, what do I do here? What do I do when I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't? You know, how do I handle this? Well, eventually they just, I guess, let it go. I still got a lot of flack, but they let it go. And I then went to college for a year, and we continued to date. And at the end of that year, we got engaged. And in 1970, we got married. Life was great. Everything was great. 1973, January 1st, 1973, we moved to Atlanta. And since that day, this is not a lie, at least on a weekly basis, I say, thank you, God, for moving me to Atlanta on January 1st, 1973. Because I don't live up north with my family of origin, and I don't know where we'd be today if we were still living there. We might not be in recovery. And so, 73, we moved to Atlanta. I didn't know till many years later that my husband was not real crazy about doing that. He had never traveled a lot. His family had never moved. They had always lived in the same place. But I was gung-ho. Let's, you know, go to Atlanta. This is great. When we got here, we had our son a month and a half later. 3 years later, we had our daughter. Life was beautiful. Life was wonderful. We refer to our marriage today in three parts. The one, the first 15 to 16 years that were wonderful. The next 6 to 7 that was the marriage from hell. And then our marriage in recovery. So at that point, we were in the great marriage. The early on, great 15 to 16 years. And in 1978, or in 1975, we built a house. And moved to Colorado Springs for a short time for a project he was working on. Came back to Atlanta, back into our house that we had built. And in 78, they asked us to go to London, England to live for at least 2 years. And we were ready, you know. And I didn't realize that every time there was a move, I was, like, excited about that move. And he was the one that had the harder time with it. But this was huge. You know, we were going to take a 16-month-old and a 5-year-old to London to live. And nobody was happy about it. Both my husband's parents were upset. Oh, my God, you're taking the kids away from us. My mom was beyond upset. The only one who ever encouraged us or had anything positive to say was my dad. And he kept saying, you know, you have to take every opportunity and you can't pass this up and you always have to do what's best for you. And he was very encouraging. So that was nice to have at least one nice voice. So we went to London thinking we were going to be there at least 2 years. And got over there, and I think in the taxi from the airport to the first temporary apartment we were in, I was staring out one window, he was staring out the other window, the kids were in between, and it was like, oh my God, what have we done? And we moved into this apartment, and he started work with the English firm that they were working with. And as we had always been drinkers, I guess, you know, people call it social drinking, and that's what we did. But in London, it was like every night, and there were nights when he would come back from the office and have another half gallon of gin, and I'd be like, well, we still have some. Well, we might run out. I didn't like the beer over there, so he must have brought 50 kinds of beer in over a month's time, trying to have me find one that I liked so that we could both drink the same one. And I don't think I ever did. But we never were without anything in that apartment. We finally moved into a place we thought was going to be more permanent. We never were without anything there. And it ended up only being there 6 months. But in that 6 months, you know, driving on the wrong side of the car and the wrong side of the road, I chose not to drive because they gave us, the company that we were working with gave us a car to use, but it was a stick shift and I didn't know how to drive that. So Scott drove the whole time. Otherwise, I took the underground with the kids in the stroller. In that 6 months, he got 3 traffic tickets and had 3 accidents. And we look back on it now, and we know that, you know, that gin probably was involved. But, you know, at the time, you know, it's just these people drive the wrong way. We're doing it right in America. They're doing it wrong here. So, you know, that continued. At 6 months, they said we were coming home, that the project had been postponed. So we moved back to Atlanta, back into our house. Life seemed to still go okay. I remember we bought one night at a drugstore or liquor store somewhere. We bought this little postcard and hung it in the liquor cabinet. And it said Attitude Adjustment Center. And that might have been a sign. And moved out of that house in, that was 78. We moved out of that house in 86. And into an apartment and started to build another house. And for me, that's when our life started to change. But the time we moved into that house, it was like, who are you? You know, what did you do with my husband? All his attitudes about everything seemed to be changing. Moral issues, political issues, it didn't matter. Everything was the opposite. One night we were talking in the kitchen about someone in the family who had gotten pregnant as a teenager. And now this child, the baby that she did have, was, I don't know, 18. But he was arguing with me, trying to convince me that she could have and should have had an abortion. And I'm thinking, the kid's 18, you know, it's, why are we arguing about this? But it was, you know, and he would often end our arguments with, why don't you just agree with me? You know, and I couldn't handle that very well. And so now we're into our marriage from hell scenario. And still I was glad that we were in the South, that we were away from family. We were very isolated. We didn't have a lot of friends from the time we came to Atlanta. We had more business acquaintances, you know, people that came and go and, you know, at the Christmas party or what have you. And so as things started to deteriorate, there was really nobody seeing this, watching this much. As that time period passed, my part of the family disease, I started to take on, hook into everything that was said. If he had been drinking and he said, you'd drink too if you were married to me, if you were married to you, I would just take that right on. You know, oh my God, I'm a terrible wife. I used to be good. He used to think I was great. You know, now I'm a horrible wife. You'd be sad too if you were married to you. You'd be angry too if you were married to you. It was just one thing after another. Then we got to a point where it was, you know, I just want to be able to introduce my wife as the president of her company. And we had agreed early on in our marriage, and I was really good with this, that I was going to be a stay-at-home mom. It meant a lot to me, and I hadn't gone into any big career early on. I wasn't really interested in that, and I was delighted to be a stay-at-home mom. I thought that was really important. Both of our moms, even though they were both the type of people they were stay-at-home moms, and I found value in that. So now here I am with, you know, two teenagers, and I'm hearing that everything I ever did was not quite right, and I hooked right in there. From birth, I was a perfectionist. You know, my mom talks about being a perfectionist about herself like it's a badge of honor. You know, she's very proud to be a perfectionist. Well, it made me very sick. I started, the more he said, the more I tried to be perfect. I spent afternoon after afternoon after afternoon one summer reading the paper, watching the news, trying to just know everything about everything, you know, and share that at dinner. Totally not the way we had lived that number of years, but just, oh, if I do this, he'll like me again. You know, if I have this for dinner for him, he'll like me again. If I do this, if I do this, if I do this. I remember one night suggesting we go to a museum. We didn't get there till 10 minutes before closing, but it was like Frank Lloyd Wright or something, and the industry he's in, and I thought, oh, he'll love that, you know, and he was just mad the whole night. When he was 40, I threw him a surprise party. Had all these people at the house. He was totally surprised. He didn't eat anything all night. He drank the whole time. He sat on the balcony or on the deck the next day, all day, totally depressed. And I'm like, I don't know what else to do. So over time, I started feeling like, you know, I don't understand what's going on. I feel like I'm losing my mind. I really feel like I am insane. And everything that he's saying indicates that he's right and I'm always wrong. And I don't understand this. And at the time I was volunteering at a hospital, and I found out that volunteers and employees at this hospital could go to free therapy sessions 4 times. And if you solved your problem, you know, this was great, you had 4 free therapy sessions. If you didn't solve your problem, they would recommend where you could go. So I asked him to go with me, and he said yes, and we went. We went the first one, and the second one, and the third one, and it got a little heated each time. And then the 4th time, he had an excuse not to go with me. And I went by myself. And the woman was like, well, I really can't do this. You're coming together. I really can't do this. And she sat there a few minutes, and finally she said, you know, maybe if we call it, maybe we start over. This is like your first individual session. The others were couple sessions. Then we could do it that way. And then whenever he'll come back with you, you know, we'll do that. We'll do that 4th session. So I said, okay. So I went 3 or 4 times to her. He finally went back with me. I think, really, I don't remember exactly. I think one of us walked out on that one. And it's just really unclear to me. But the bottom line was, obviously, we can't help you here. And we haven't been able to help you, Sherry, alone. We haven't been able to help you all as a couple. And we highly recommend you go for some, you know, further, deeper counseling. So, when they suggested that, I ran that by him one morning, and he told me he would go with me, and I called the therapist they recommended, and we went. And when we got there, she had another therapist with her, another man, and she said, I don't believe in doing couples therapy with only one therapist. I don't want anybody to ever feel ganged up in the room, so we always have 2 therapists in the room for couples. We were like, okay. And then she asked, you know, who drug who here? And he volunteered, you know, I guess she drug me here. Well, we went about 6 times. And drinking came up numerous times. And at one point, she suggested that neither one of us drink for like 45 days. Let's just do that and see how it goes. And she had suggested Al-Anon to me in front of him, and he said, oh, I'll go there with you. And she looked at him and said, no, that wouldn't be for you. That would be for her. You know, you would go to AA. Well, you know, shut down there. So she suggested the 45-day thing. Well, that lasted about 4 days, 5 days maybe. I picked him up at MARTA, and he asked me to stop at the liquor store, and I was like, oh, no, you know, we're supposed to be doing this. Well, you know, he had a few choice words to say about the therapist, and we stopped, and he went in the liquor store, and we went home. So things continued to escalate, and one week when we were supposed to go to therapy, they called us, and they said, you know, here's the deal, or it might have been the last session. We know what Sherry wants. We know she wants things to be better. We know she wants your life to get better, your marriage to get better. But Scott, we don't really know what the hell you want. And until you have a direction to go in, even if it's you want a divorce, we have nothing to work with. We have nothing to work toward. So he said, okay. And the next week he asked me if I minded if we canceled. And I said, no, that's okay. He said, well, I have to think about what they said. And I took that as, you know, great encouragement. He's thinking about what they said. So the following week, I asked him, I said, okay, should I make the next appointment? And he said, no, I don't think I'm going back there. I don't get anything out of that. You can go if you want to, but I don't think I'm going back. Well, that was like devastating, you know. And I called this therapist and told her what he said, and she said, well, you know, give it a week and ask him if he would come with you one time, and then we can separate it out. You come to me and he can go to the man, and, you know, we'll just try it that way. Well, I waited a week and he still, no, he didn't want to go. And at the end of the next week, I called her and I think I was literally yelling at her. I know I was in tears. And I begged her to see me alone. I said, I think I am losing my mind. This is not going anywhere good, and I have to talk to somebody. And like I said, we were so isolated that nobody knew what was going on. You know, he went to work in the morning after our argument. I sat there depressed all day. Then I got cleaned up so that the kids wouldn't know what was going on, and it was a mess. So she agreed to see me, and I started going to her. In October 1st, 1992, and every 6 weeks I would shove the insurance form in front of him because the insurance was sent through his company for him to sign, and he would be like, what's this? And I'd say, it's my, you know, appointments at Jean's, and he would scribble a signature as fast as he could and push it back to me like, oh my God, we don't want to talk about this, you know. So I continued to go, and I found out down the road that her appointments were really only 50 minutes, but I was always there more than an hour. And she told me later on that it took her 6 months to get me to talk about me and my feelings and my background. She said I came in and gave her play-by-play-by-play of every argument, every word he said, every word I said, everything that went on in the week since I'd seen her. And she said, it took me 50 minutes every week to get to you. So I was like, well, you only charged me for the 50 minutes. And she said, I know. It's okay. So I continued to go to her, but she very early on in those sessions started to ask me to go to Al-Anon. And she would ask me when I walked in the door, did you go to Al-Anon? And she would tell me, or she would say when I was leaving, please go to Al-Anon. Well, I didn't want to go to Al-Anon, because I thought it was a misery loves company type thing, and I was miserable enough, and I didn't want to hear anybody else's stuff. You know, I just really don't want to do that. But I did guilt really well, because with my mom, that you do guilt. And so I got to a week where I thought, I cannot go in there Tuesday afternoon and tell her I did not go to Al-Anon again. You know, I have to go to one, just so I can say, yes, I did it. So at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, I went to Tucker, as far away from where we lived as I could find one that was in the morning during the week. I didn't want him to know that I was doing this. And I got to that meeting, and my knees were like jelly that morning, and there were about 35 people sitting in a circle around all these tables. And I sat down, and I told myself, there's no way on this earth I'm going to talk in this place, and start listening. And about the fifth or sixth person that talked was a lady who was about 82. I didn't know that day, but I found that out later. And she was talking about how she had been in Al-Anon 22 years. And the first words that went through my mind were, I'll be damned if I do this the rest of my life. I am not doing this. It's not me, you know. And then it started to go through the next people, and I'm in tears at that point, just sitting there, you know, with the tears rolling down my face. And I know at least five people described what was going on in my living room at my house. Well, that was pretty amazing, because you always, you know, we always think we're the only one living in that hell. And I thought, wow, you know, this is too ironic, you know. And they weren't bitching, you know, they were just sharing what they were going through, and some of them were laughing, and some of them were way past it, you know, and that was amazing. So by the time it got to me, I know I did say something, and it may have been just that it sounded like people had been at my house, but I still had the feeling that, I'm not coming here. And that meeting, just like the meeting here on Monday nights, you know, they make the suggestion you should go to 6 to 8 meetings before you decide if it's for you or not. Well, I already decided. You know, I don't think I'm doing this. But I got in the car, and I drove to, I forget what, I think it was a McDonald's, and I sat in the parking lot and ate before I was going to my 1 o'clock therapy session, and I was going to be able to tell Gene, I went, I did it, you know, I don't have to feel guilty today. And in that parking lot, I read this pamphlet. It's called Alcoholism, a Merry-Go-Round Named Denial. And I read it from period to period, and it was like, oh my God, this is my life. This is, you know, I could plug our family into it. It was pretty incredible. So now I was in, you know, I had a dilemma here. Should I go back or not? You know, I can tell her I went, but this is amazing. This is like my life in a pamphlet. So I went to my therapy session, and she was thrilled that I went and begged me to keep going back. And the next Tuesday, I went back. And so for several months then, every Tuesday, I went to the 10:30 Al-Anon meeting and the 1 o'clock therapy session. And during that time, there was one particular night I remember that my husband had a business function on Monday night. And it seemed like every time he did something really bad, he did it on Monday nights. And then Tuesday morning, I was like, thank you, God. You know, I get to go to Al-Anon and therapy to deal with it, you know. And so this particular night, in the Al-Anon meetings, you know, they were telling me what to do and what not to do. And, you know, one woman kept telling me over and over after the meeting, you know, you don't have to stand in that room and hook into that argument. Don't ask the question when he walks in the door. You know the answer. That starts the argument. You know, you don't have to do this stuff. Leave the room if you have to. Well, I was trying what they were telling me, but, you know, they didn't tell me what to do when I left the room and he's circling behind me, you know. And I haven't been called a bitch in almost 20 years, but for 2 years before recovery, that was my name. I didn't hear the name Sherry. And so it would be like I would say, I'm not doing this with you, and I'd leave the room. And he would come follow me, you know, like a puppy, around and around and around this hallway and through our family room. You know, that's it, bitch. Just you know, leave the room. You never finish the argument. You know, I'm like, oh, my God. They didn't tell me what to do with this. I was used to waking him up off the floor after he passed out in the family room and taking an hour, 2 hours, you know. Come to bed, come to bed, come to bed. Getting out of the bed, going back in there. The family room's right off of our bedroom, so, you know, it was just constant path. And some nights he would wake up, his head was under the coffee table now, so he was, you know, busting into that. And so I worried about that. Well, now in Al-Anon, they were saying, don't wake him up off the floor. You know, he'll come to bed when he's going to come to bed. Don't do that. So I would lay in bed, and it reminded me of when we took our son off the baby bottle. When he was up in the crib crying, except that my husband wasn't crying, he was passed out. But I would be laying there thinking, oh my God, this is horrible. I'm a horrible wife, just like I thought I was a horrible mother back then, you know. This is just so horrible. So, and in the meantime, I'm thinking, they said he'll notice that you're not doing these things, but I'm thinking he's not noticing anything. He's just continuing to do the same stuff over and over, you know, and I'm expecting it to be different. So, we got to May, I think it was, and my grandfather passed away. And my son was away at college. He was coming home that same weekend as the funeral. There was no way he was going to be able to go to the funeral with us. And my husband had a business trip. So it was like, okay, my daughter and I got in the car and we drove to Kentucky to the funeral. My son came home from college while we were gone. My husband came home from the business trip while we were gone. And that weekend before we got back home, my daughter and I, evidently was pretty horrendous happenings there. Scott, you know, had too much to drink, and my son came in with some friends, and there were things going on, and they've both told me bits and parts, you know, over the years. But Scott couldn't find his glasses. He's trying to put his watch on his face as his glasses. You know, Patrick's friends are there. He's totally humiliated, and one thing after another. And Patrick evidently just read his dad the riot act and, you know, told him off. So I come back from the trip, and I don't know about any of this. And the day that, you know, Monday comes and my husband goes to work, my son's like giving me a speech. We have to sit down and talk to him. Something's got to change here. All year I've been calling home from school, and you are so depressed, Mom, I'm worried you're going to kill yourself. And Dad's tongue is so thick, I can't understand a word he's saying. And it's just getting worse and worse. And he humiliated me in front of my friends. We have to sit him down. So I then proceeded to tell my son, who at the time was 20, I've been going to therapy. I've been going to Al-Anon. The therapist has offered several times to get somebody to help us with an intervention. But I had drugged my feet on that because I felt like we were so isolated that the only people that would be there would be me and our kids. And he had already said numerous times that I was brainwashing the kids. Now, both our kids graduated high school and college, summa cum laude, and they aren't dumb kids. And we learned later that my daughter had been doing research on alcoholism for many months. She had papers and papers and papers that she had written out. I had no idea about that. So I told my son, I said, you know, hold on. I go to the therapy on Tuesday. I'll talk to her. So we hired the interventionist. I went first by myself. I didn't. I went with the kids, 16 and 20. We went together. And he quizzed me for a while. And then he started talking to the kids. And at some point he said, okay, I'll help you. You know, and I looked at him like, what do you mean you will help me? I thought that's why we were here. You know, Gene said you would help us. And he said, well, a lot of people come to me who are looking for ammunition to get a divorce, you know, to use against the spouse. He said, but the things your children have shared with me, there's a problem here. And I can see that you all are here for genuine reason, and I will help you. So he then asked me, he met with me alone. He asked me to go through all the people in the family. Who else can we involve in this? He said he would check with my husband's firm to see if there was anybody. I told him there was one man that had questioned, you know, things about our life that I could talk to, so I met him for lunch. He felt like, you know, Scott's drinking at work was so hidden that nobody else knew about it, so he said, I don't think we can help you. I then met with the interventionist again, and he said, your husband's firm is virtually run by alcoholics, so I don't think we can bring anybody in there. So now I'm like, oh my God, you know. I mean, I just felt like I was drowning. You know, the therapy was helping, the Al-Anon was helping, but like, can we not get out of, how can we get out of this? You know? So we finally put it together with the two kids, me. One of my brothers who lived in Birmingham at the time, who had been around when Scott had a little too much to drink and witnessed some things. My mother and my father passed away in 82 of pancreatic cancer. So a few years later, my mother married Joe. And she and Joe had witnessed some things when they came to town. That ended up probably being a really big mistake that we had them there, because her initial reaction when the man called her was, well, I'll just write Scott a letter and tell him all this stuff. And now I'm getting calls from the interventionist, I'm getting calls from her, everybody's worried that she's going to blow the whistle, we aren't going to be able to do this, you know, how are we going to pull this off? So I don't know what he threatened her with, but somehow this man convinced my mother over the phone long distance that you cannot write him a letter, you cannot blow the whistle, you cannot tell him anything, you know, you just have to be there that morning if you have something you want to say to him. My daughter's best friend asked to be involved, and Michelle told me that she had said they had known each other since fourth grade. And Michelle said, Kelly said that she felt like we were family and she had watched our family go down the tubes and she would like to be there. So that was the group. Then I had to tell the man that, well, I don't know when we're going to do this, but we're going to have, if you're talking Saturday, we're going to have to do it like really early, because he'll get up and go to work all day Saturday and Sunday, and he'll get up and go to work early on the weekdays. He works around the clock. He's a workaholic too, so I don't know when we will do this. So he said, well, we'll just make it early enough on a Saturday morning. Met with him one more time, and he said, we'll do it July the 3rd. And I was like, well, that's 4th of July weekend. And he said, well, okay, we can do it later, but it'll have to be at least 2 or 3 weeks because I've got other things that I have on the calendar. If you want to go through 2 or 3 more weeks of this, that's fine, but we can do it July 3rd. Well, I thought about it for a minute, and I was like, okay, you know. At that point in time in our house, I mean, there was no communication. We had no communication, total breakdown, a lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, a lot of name-calling, nothing good. I remember a couple times when Saturdays when there was knockdown drag-out fights and our daughter would try to get in the middle of it. She was the cheerleader, you know, good guy that was going to fix everything. And I knew it was getting really bad when he started to kind of come down on her too, when she was trying to fix it and he was yelling at her the same as me. And one particular Saturday, he went out in the kitchen and we heard the lid of a can. And I remember her saying, I'll be damned if that's a beer, I'll kill him. Well, it was a beer. And she then turned to me and screamed at me worse than I had ever heard her scream at her dad. Why are you here? Why don't you leave? Why don't you divorce him? Why are you doing this? You know. So I realized at some point that my kids were madder at me now than they were at their dad. Like, you know, he's not got a handle on anything and he's passing out every night. You're the sane one, go, you know. But what they didn't realize is I wasn't the sane one. I was as sick as he was at that point. So we did the intervention. It lasted 4.5 hours. The man told me it would be about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, that rarely did you have to do consequences. And it was an incredible Saturday morning. I woke him up out of the bed at 6:30, told him we had company. He had no clue what time it was or anything. He had come in at 12:30 the night before from a going-away party for somebody at the office, and he was pretty bad off. So he got out of the bed and put on a clean starch shirt and whole business, you know, came out, and here's the family members sitting there, you know, Michelle's friend, and two people he never saw in his life. And the interventionist's wife was a nurse, and she came with all the statistics. So, like I said, it lasted 4.5 hours. He had multiple reasons why he couldn't go anywhere right now. He had a big job. He was important at his work, blah, blah, blah. It went in and out, in and out, in and out, until the interventionist said, Sherry, why don't you go make everybody coffee and, you know, I'll see if I can talk with him. And I said, well, I hate to tell you this, Roy, but I don't make coffee. I don't drink coffee. I don't like coffee. We've been married 42 years, but he makes the coffee. So we had asked Scott to make the coffee. This was great, you know. So then he goes out, and they walk around the house together. He's still not going to go. Finally, when he agreed to go, later, you know, just I got from it was, I'll go do this, and then I'll get out of there, and I'll do it just to get rid of the bitch and repair the damage with the kids. So now we're going to drive to Ridgeview, and he wants to drive his own car. And the intervention said, you can't drive your own car. You'll go in our van. he said, Sherry will drive your car. She'll come behind us. So the kids and I and, you know, the two of them with Scott came to Ridgeview. I had no clue where we were going. I never heard of Ridgeview before that day. I think it ended up that he was in the car with me, but the nurse was in the back seat. Our son was in the van with the interventionist trying to sell him Cutco. I mean, we were we were real sick. So, you know, on the way, I remember turning off of Atlanta Road over here onto Ridge Road, and he's like, where is this place? And I said, I don't know. You know, I trust this man. I've met with him several times. Well, how much is it going to cost? I don't know. You know, I couldn't answer any of the questions. All I knew was this had to end. Somebody here was going to die, him or me. Something bad was going to happen. And, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom for 22 years. People questioned the fact that I did this and had no plan for money or anything. You know, even the therapist asked me at one point, is he hoarding money so you think he's trying to leave, or are you hoarding money so you can leave? No. I mean, money didn't occur to me. It was just, we've got to end this hell we're living in. So we checked in at Ridgeview. The kids sat in the lobby with the nurse, and I went back with him to sign the papers. And at some point, he asked, where does it say that I can leave of my own volition? Where does it say that? And she said, well, it's not actually on the form, but legally, you know, if you're not a threat to yourself or anybody else, you can leave. Well, he couldn't stand it that it wasn't on there. So finally she said, well, you just write it out and we'll all sign it. So we did that. And he was planning to leave, but he stayed 13 months at Ridgeview. He does everything in excess. I that day, even though I had learned so much about the disease, you know, I just had this feeling like, okay, we're home free now. You know, we're going to go back to the happy times and everything's going to be great. And what I didn't realize was it was just kind of just beginning. The best lecture I ever heard at Ridgeview that summer was in this room. And this therapist was talking about how the reason it's called a family disease, and how when you take away the substance, the pill, the bottle, the glass, the needle, whatever it is, you still have a lot to deal with. And that was very evident. Things got worse, I'd say, than before they got better. All the lies started coming out. There was a therapy session here at Ridgeview where I know I went into fetal position on the couch. I was so devastated by some of the stuff. And so We stopped therapy at one point because he didn't like to do therapy, and the following February we went back to it, and we lived apart for 13 months. At the 7-week point where he told me he wasn't coming home indefinitely, I was devastated because I thought we're going to be happily ever after again. But over time in that separation, that was the best gift our marriage ever had. That was a gift from God for me. I feel like in that time I was able to find myself, to learn who I was, to become a whole person. I can't stand those cards in the greeting card stores that say, to your better half, because I got to a point where I don't want to be a half of anything, you know. And I got to a point where if he comes home, which I think he will, it'll be great. If he doesn't come home, I can make it. I got married at 19. I had never been on my own. But therapy and Al-Anon, I had therapy and Al-Anon. I've had Al-Anon a long time, but therapy for that 2 solid years, every week, sometimes more than once a week. Some of us are sicker than others, if one of our readings has in it. Just really helped me. Helped me to see the baggage I brought to our marriage. Helped me to see the things in our families of origin. Helped me to see that I suffer from the same disease, I just didn't use the way he did. And that's what that lecture told me that night. Oh my God, you know, I have the same thing. I was a perfectionist. Today I call myself a recovering perfectionist. I like so much better the way I live today. I like myself so much better today. In that first year, I remember my son coming home from work in the summer, and he gave me hell because I had become this uncaring person. You know, you're not doing anything for anybody anymore. And he just laid me out. You have become the most selfish woman in the world. And he went into his room, and I went in the kitchen, and I was like, yes. You know, like, oh, somebody's noticing. Things are different, you know. I just felt so good about that. I wanted so much for our kids to go to some kind of recovery programs. I didn't care what. To this day, they have chosen not to do that. They are 36 and 40. The miracle of our recovery was, and the therapist kept telling me, there will be a trickle-down effect. And one of the big miracles, I think, is that at the intervention, we did have to say consequences. And the consequences our kids gave him were that you don't have to be my dad anymore. You haven't been my dad for a long time. And my son said, I don't have to come back here, and my daughter was going to move out. And today they're married, and we are very close, and there was a trickle-down effect. And I still see the disease in them, and they both married adult children of alcoholics, which I was told they'd either marry an alcoholic or they'd be one. But, you know, I see all four of them dancing around in this disease, and I just pray hard for them because I've made the suggestions and that's all I can do. And we are blessed to have 8 grandchildren and seen them all, you know, and I really believe at the day of the intervention I thought I will never see any of this ever. Miracles happen in Al-Anon. Miracles have happened in my life due to being in recovery. And I don't know why it took us so long to get there, and I don't know why we had to go through some of the hell and the things we did, some of the hurtful things, but it got us here. It got us here. And, you know, I said, I'll be damned if I do this the rest of my life. In January, I celebrated 20 years in Al-Anon, and I will do this the rest of my life. With or without Scott, it helps me in everything. You know, God willing, on July 3rd, he will be sober 20 years. But he's still an alcoholic, and those behaviors and those attitudes still jump out there on a regular basis. That disease is still there. And I always say, I'll die an Al-Anon, and he'll die an alcoholic, even if we're in recovery. That's what we are. Miracles happen in these programs. And if you're new to it, you know, and don't know if you want to do it or not, give it a try. Just give it a try. I think some of my favorite things in the program are the Serenity Prayer, the third step. The third step got me through that intervention, and the slogan, Let Go and Let God. I think I repeated that slogan 4 million times the night before. I was so scared. The 10th step, I don't think I'll ever be able to exaggerate again in my life. You know, I no longer can say, oh my God, did you see that million birds fly over, that I don't correct it and say, well, it was a few hundred. You know, I mean, it's like I can't even say something like that. It's insane. I get through things with my kids when they're insane, with the grandchildren when it's too overwhelming, with the person that cut you off in traffic, with our business. The miracle of our life is that we have a business together and we haven't killed each other the last 15 years. With our clients, with so many things. With my family of origin, my first sponsor of 9 years passed away, but she told me repeatedly, the longer you're in recovery, the more you will see the disease in people around you, people in your life. And that is ever so true with my family of origin. Every one of them belongs in some program or another. It is amazing. I wish that my dad and my husband's mother would have had Al-Anon. They both could have used it. And if they have Al-Anon in heaven, maybe they're, you know, participating in that. The one thing that I wanted to read before I quit is that this little Just for Today card that we have in Al-Anon. I had to find one that wasn't all tattered and torn in my stuff at home, and I won't be able to find it now. Okay, this one paragraph, I think, has gotten me through millions of things over the last 20 plus years. And I still read it and I still say it in my head for so many things. Just for today, I will try to live through this day only and not tackle all my problems at once. I can do something for 12 hours that would appall me if I felt that I had to keep it up for a lifetime. I cannot tell you how that helps me in my life. It just repeatedly helps me in my life. We just came from Denver for the birth of the sixth child out there, and the oldest one's 9. And I repeated that in my head a dozen times a day while I was there. There's a reason God gives you babies when you're young. And 62 is not when you have 5 kids running around, you know, for the birth of the sixth one. It was overwhelming, but my Al-Anon program got me through it. My Al-Anon program gets me through so many things, and I will do this the rest of my life. I tell people in all the groups I go to, you know, if you ever question whether this particular meeting's here, I'll be there. You know, I may be the only one, but I'll be there, so come, you know, because it would be nice to have more than one person. I just can't say enough about Al-Anon. I can't say enough about AA, and I can't say enough about this particular place we're standing in. I feel like AA, Al-Anon, and Ridgeview, and the wonderful therapist we had saved our life, saved my life, saved our marriage. Keep coming back. It really does work. Miracles happen here. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. It's a great speech talk.